to Mind Crime Liberty Show with me, Swithin Dobson, and him, Tim Patton. Today we discuss, are people evil or are they just ignorant? Now this might seem an odd topic, but this goes back to Plato, at least, in his dialogue in Meno. And it also goes to the heart of some of the social reform movements of the 19th century, who thought that if we could just educate people, then crime would disappear because people committed crime because they were ignorant rather than that they were somehow evil in some sort of metaphysical sense. So this question is actually goes to the heart of a lot of contemporary debates. So, Tim, you've had some thoughts on this.
I've been thinking about this question for a while, ever since it occurred in Nassim Taleb's Q&A. Nassim Taleb, for his book, I think Black Swan or Anti-Fragile, someone asked him, basically the question was, are people evil or are they making mistakes? The question was regarding terrorism or some variety of particular example. And like, you know, if someone had a bomb blow up the whole world, would they do it because they thought it was a good thing to do? This is where I got the citation for the Meno dialogue. This is the first time I read it in full earnest and full thing. Meno dialogue is quite a effective dialogue. It's a Platonic dialogue. I will summarize what the position in it in a second is. But the Socrates position in it is that no one really advocates evil. So no one really is evil. That people are primarily making mistakes. I'm going to read a good summary of it. The Meno is taken by is a transitional dialogue, and they discuss the possibility of knowing something that is bad and desiring to secure that bad thing for oneself. Meno starts off the argument by stating that several times that it's possible that someone can know bad things to be bad and still desire them. But when Socrates connects up the idea of knowing something is bad, or a bad thing is equivalent to something that harms oneself or leads to one's unhappiness, with the idea that no one wants to be miserable, Meno changed his mind. So Socrates and Meno end up agreeing that no one can know that a thing is bad and simultaneously desire that thing. I'll go for the actual text here. This is Socrates says, and do you really imagine, Meno, that a man knows evils to be evils and desires them notwithstanding? And then Meno replies, and this is where Meno is just taking sort of a commonsensical view. Certainly do. And then Socrates says, and desire is a possession. Yes, a possession. And does he think that the evils will do him good who possess them, or does he know that they will do him harm? Are some people who think they will know they will do them harm? And this is where Socrates, to me, defined the column of people that I don't think really exists. This is where he gets the idea that people only desire them because it's either in their self-interest, and it's only in their, air quote, self-mistaken self-interest, or they're just ignorant. And later in the dialogue, he comes up with his theory of ignorance. And this is where you get Socrates. I won't read any more of it because you can read it as if your case. But I will say that another key site to position this is book one of the Plato's Republic. And this is where I can't pronounce the Greek names, English translations of them. But this is where Socrates gets his idea of, like, you know, what is just as well, because just is partly is integral to this. And one of the things that this interlocutor says, well, you know, justice is doing good to your friends and harm to your enemies. And this is a definition also comes up in this dialogue as well. Well, now one of the quick things that Socrates tries to push back is, what if are they a true friend? You know, if a friend tells you something that is actually leads to your harm, it leads to your falling apart or misery. If a friend gives you advice that ends poorly for you, they're not really friends. They're not really your friend. They're actually your enemy. So even there, Socrates dismantles the sort of So in this regard. He tries to position that Socrates is a true friend. He's illuminating that, you know, these people are telling you this wrong advice. They're actually really your enemies. So I have always thought this dialogue is interesting. And one of the reasons I think this dialogue is interesting is its relationship to theological debates. And this gets picked up by Thomas Aquinas. Thomas Aquinas takes it a lot from Plato and Aristotle as well, indirectly. But I've always I always like this stuff because, you know, take the left's favorite boogeyman currently or historically, Richard Spencer, Dylan Roof, Hitler, Pinochet, you know, Jefferson Davis, whoever boogeyman the left wants to think. They say, well, are these people evil? And, well, who knows? I mean, this is, to me, a very interesting question. Or take the right's favorite boogeyman, you know, Stalin, the common criminal, a rebelling slave, let's say a rebelling slave in the South. Okay, I mean, those would be the rights or heretics, you know, different right wings will have different boogeymen. But to take all them together, you know, do they do their actions because they think there are that they will end up in good? Do they, let's say take Hitler. Does he kill the Jews because he think there are good? Or does he because he doesn't, for some evil reason, air quote evil. Now, I think Socrates, if you're really being charitable to both Hitler and Socrates, is saying, the only that if you have a good reason to kill someone, or if you have a good reason to murder someone, this applies to the common criminal or the big criminal, the big state one. The reasoning is the same. It's, if anything, it's the question of how do we extinguish or physically remove the people quick enough. So I will divide the general conversation to four reasons. Number one, disagreement of what exactly is the good in itself. That's thing one. Disagreement over how to attain the good. Disagreement of whether people/will strive for good things. And disagreement over the ability to attain the thing, the good itself. I think there's a good summary of Socrates' position, both Book One, Plato's Republic, as well as the Meno Dialogue. Now I could say that three and four are basically the same, but if you're an anarchist and you think Social Security is wrong, for example, if you think invading the Bush or the Clinton administration invading Iraq, you can try to do social action to change it, but you know. You might not be able to do it. The state will put you in jail. You know, Julian Assange and Edward Snowden in some ways tried to rebel against the state. And now they're both, one's in Russia, one's in a Belmarsh prison. So, you know, there's a certain ability. You're not always able to resist, you know, the action. These are macro actions. But I could use smaller cases, too. You know, you say, well, maybe actually what Julian Assange and Edward Snowden are doing is actually wrong. Maybe Donald Rumsfeld is right. Maybe Rumsfeld is acting good. These are terrorists, and they need to. The state needs to shut down discourse to stop the Iranians from blowing up the whole world with a nuclear weapon they maintain. That's the Rumsfeld view. If your one's being charitable, so actually Rumsfeld is doing good, and it's just a necessary evil. And therefore, it's not even really an evil. It's actually a positive good. So this dialogue to me is really interesting because if you get down to it, there's a lot of like dialectical positions in there that come out where it becomes a question over, you know, how do you attain it and what do you think is the good itself? You know, you get out of the sort of, such and such is a baddie, such and such is a goodie, thinking, you think, well, you know, is desiring prosperity or so forth a good thing or a bad thing? And the same way with a common murder, this is a classic example. You know, if the murder or the common thief, I'll use, if the thief steals a loaf of bread to feed his family, okay, this is the classic anarcho-syndicalist position. That's actually a good thing. The thief should steal the loaf of bread from the baker. Now you could respond, well, what does the baker do? That's a good counter response. But you know, the desire to feed one's family is also good. So this is where conflict comes up, and this is also its relationship to economics, too, here. So, Swithin, I've outlined my four positions, the good summary, I think, of the dialogue. So far, what do you make of my summary, and what do you make of the Meno dialogue itself on whether people are good, evil, or mistaken? And we'll get to ignorance and knowledge later in the discussion, but I want to first get your thoughts on that.
It is an interesting dialogue. I think it is certainly true that people always act to achieve an apparent good. So whatever they think is something has some value to them, and so they act accordingly. I think that is certainly true. The question arises, though, is what they desire, as it were, good and as a whole. So a way of looking at things would be to say that, well, every sort of physical object has some apparent good for it because it exists, and existence is the grounds of any good. So anything that exists must have some form of good in it, at least partially. And so, you know, you can have reasons for sort of desiring anything in a certain way. The question would be whether that was, as it were, a justified course of action, or whether or whether there are other goods that they ought to have pursued instead, which will overall be more good, and whether or not the good that they attempt to achieve also has sort of like a privation associated with it. So, for example, you know, the murderer, he kills somebody, he wants his money, for example, but you could say this is a privation of the just ordering of his sort of I don't know, his depending how he killed him or something along those lines. So you could go that way. I think, though, in this case, the interesting question is whether people always strive for things that they think are good or not. Because what the one way in which Plato seems to take things is a somewhat formalistic approach, which is, well, you only ever do that which you think is good to do, which I think is true in a certain respect. And this is kind of the basis of sort of Misesian or Rothbardian Austrian economics, based on demonstrated preference, that you walk to the supermarket to buy a loaf of bread shows that you think that that's the most highly viable action you could attain, even though it might be the case that your house is burning down. Now, in retrospect, you might have decided that actually, no, it would have been best to try to prevent my house from burning down. But at the time, you decided that, you know, going to buy a loaf of bread was a good idea. But when you get to, now that's a slightly strange example, but probably a more relevant one here would be something like, you know that you shouldn't, let's suppose you have the intuition that you shouldn't get angry and shout at your mother, for example, who is annoying you because she asks you lots of technical queries all the time and doesn't follow them properly and is generally hard work. Let's suppose you decide that you know that that's nothing you should do. She's your mother, and therefore you have various obligations towards her to treat her in a particular manner. However, when you get into a situation in which she is annoying, you might then get very irate and angry at her. Are you doing what you know to be good there? Well, in a way, yes, but I think in another way, no. Because I think if you were to ask you if you had a more stable sort of personal equilibrium, as it were, you know, out of the situation, sort of a dispassionate position, was that a justified thing? Should you have done that? Then you might have said no. But when you're in that situation and you're sort of, as it were, your passions are raised, then the will would seem to focus on chooses to focus on things that it wouldn't do in other situations. So I do think it the case that you can, as it were, act against what you know to be good in that respect. As it relates to whether people are evil, etc., you mentioned Stalin and sort of political figures, I think many people today take a view that, oh, their opponents are just evil, however they so define that, which I think is a very sort of shallow evaluation in many cases. because you could have somebody, and this is probably the most interesting case, is attempts to who is genuinely trying to achieve a particular goal that you both agree on. Let's suppose it is increasing the wages of the lowest paid, but they disagree on the means to achieve it, but they sort of are honest in that respect. And are they evil even though we disagree with them? Probably not, at least as far as that goes. However, if you have somebody who claims that they want to achieve that goal, but then works against it, then I think you could probably make a case of lying as at least a prima facie marker of sort of evil, in the sense of they are not dealing with you in good faith. Although that said, you could then make the claim that lying is required and any means necessary to achieve the goal is justifiable. Although that might take us a little bit further afield, because that then we go to the nature of lying and whether it's justifiable in certain circumstances or not. Those would be some of my initial thoughts on sort of your fourfold categorization of the issue here.
So I'm gonna continue here. I'm gonna bring up two examples. First of all, I'm gonna bring up the classic example, which was actually provoked Nassim Taleb's answer to this. It was about international terrorism, and let's take two examples. Take two examples of terrorism. We'll take a school shooting, and we'll take the standard view of 9/11. This is the non-Alex Jones interpretation. This is just a view that Islamic terrorists blew it up. I've actually seen this view defended on the left, and I've seen the school shootings vaguely defended by Michael Malice as well. So, I mean, you could both think that both people have motives to do it. So I'll take the Bin Ladens and the... Okay, so the World Trade Center, this is the center of American capitalism, the Pentagon, the center of American intervention. You know, his country was invaded at some point. You know, you have a long history of imperialism and so forth. I mean, Noam Chomsky would agree. So, you know, is Osama bin Laden just in blowing up the World Trade Center and Pentagon? By some sense, he is just, if you really think that seriously. This is one of the reasons why third worldism to me is a long-running, interesting line of discourse. You know, is the third world just to kill us all and distribute our wealth? That's one of the reasons why I think it's so interesting of a topic. But the same way the school shooting. I mean, I think most of these school shootings are either they have screws loose, they're mentally ill, or they were treated quite poorly by their teachers or classmates in school, and they just want revenge, and they haven't gotten a good job. I mean, if you look at they're generally very smart, but they haven't got a good job. Now, a lot of the left will say, well, that's capitalism's fault. But then again, you could argue that. But both cases, you could say, well, their actions they're doing are good, by their own first-person view, and by certain in-group views, too. Now, this may go to the view that, you know, what exactly is the good, and it's back to point number one. Point number one is good. You know, what exactly is the good? And, you know, how do you deal with, air quotes, injustice? But I don't want to go too far into that point. But I want to bring up another example. And this is an example that's more related to economics, or life itself. You know, what exactly is a good life? Say, and this is about weakness. Well, say, you know, I don't want to get out, and this will go to the reform movements too. I don't want to get up in bed in the morning. I just want to watch porn, masturbate, and smoke weed. Okay, now you could say, now there's two things you could think about this. Okay, you could think, A, you could either think, well, is this a good thing to do? Or B, you think, well, I really want to get a job, get a wife, and so forth. Now you could try to say, well, which option is actually the good option? Option number one or option number two? One maneuver to do, which I think is interesting, which is the Thaddeus Russell maneuver, and say that actually point number one is actually the good life. Point number two is actually the bad life. No one, who wants to be a master? Who wants to work for a corporation? Who wants to have, a wife? Who wants to have all those responsibilities? This is one of the themes of his Renegade History of the United States. It was the renegades, the you know, the nun. And this is also one of his critiques of socialism. This is Foucault's critique of socialism as well. That socialism is a sort of puritanical idea. It has sort of bourgeois notions of good and bad, that, you know, that it's just basically Puritan family model, universalized in some sense. If anyone disagrees that, they can. I think Thad Russell fairly well put. He interviewed the late Michael Brooks. I think someone, another one of the Zero Books crowd, on his podcast. I think he does a fairly good job at explaining how that socialism is quite puritanical. And a while back, I interviewed Keith Preston on another show, and Keith Preston would tend to agree in the sense that actual existing socialism, they would force you to work. You were not allowed to smoke weed. I mean, some people were at some points, but you know, it's not like the Chernobyl miners were, you know, allowed to. I mean, they were allowed to, you know, smoke weed all day. The first maneuver is one. You know, I'm gonna ask you, Swithin, you know, as far as this, you know, and you can debate, well, how do you attain that? And then it's a question of how do you attain things. Maybe some people aren't good at attaining that, and they'll starve to death if they don't get out of bed in the morning. Maybe some people have, you know, a benefactor that can fund the money and they can live like that. So Swithin, my first example, my two examples, what do you make of those examples? And this is where we'll get into knowledge and as well as the reform movements. What do you make of my two examples? Like the person who just wants to sit in bed all day and, you know, do various activities. And of course, the two groups, the two examples of the terrorists. Are these people just ignorant of what the good is? Are they weak-willed? Do they really want to be good and they just can't do it? You know, is Osama bin Laden? Does he just want a republic of Iraq or does he want some ISIS to whatever? Is there some good in there or what do you make of it, Swithin?
First thing to say with respect to sort of school shooters and 9/11 or bin Laden, etc., is certainly that their course of action is, in a sense, rational. That is, it has definable motives, and the means that they use to achieve the goal that the motives supply makes sense. I think that's certainly true. And I think, especially on the political end, as an aside, slightly off topic, as it were, the designation of certain individuals of quote-unquote rogue states as being crazy or mad is false. They just don't have the same goals as other people do. It's not that they lack any sort of reason ability. So Kim Jong-un would be a good example of that. But as to the question of to why they did it, Thomas Aquinas would generally split he would refer to as sinful actions into three categories as to why you commit them. One would be ignorance. Second would be weakness of will. And the third would be malice. And for our purposes here, what people generally consider evil would probably be malice, but I'll deal with that last. The first would be ignorance. It is possible in certain courses of action that, you know, people are ignorant of what will happen. So, for example, a good example is a child picks up a knife and throws it at somebody. So this child's 3 years old or something, 4 years old, throws a knife and it hits someone's neck in a very unfortunate part and cuts the artery and kills them. Is the child is the child responsible for that? Is the child evil? Well, no. One, you could say they don't have sort of reasoning ability as such. But you can make the prima facie claim that they did not know what they were doing. Now, it would be possible that somebody could be retarded in that way, could be excused. Now, let's suppose someone who you consider generally rational. So you could say that, for example, a child is not a rational actor in the sense that Dylan Roof or Osama bin Laden are. Are they... why do Osama bin Laden and Dillinger do what they do? Do they know that killing people is wrong as such? Are they innocent people whom they're killing? Well, I suppose it's possible you could say they're ignorant of that, but that seems unlikely, assuming you think that these people haven't done things worthy of death. Let's just assume we think that's the case. But it is possible that some people could do actions which result in them, but do it out of ignorance, which would be somebody feeds somebody they don't know is has poison in it, and then they die as a result of it. But I suppose, again, that's one down of intention, but that'd be unintentional. So you couldn't intentionally kill somebody out of
ignorance. I'm going to make a point I think you're trying to make in a way that I've heard it before. There's mild ignorance and there's major ignorance. So let's say you're in a plane, okay? If you put most people in a plane, they won't know how to land a plane, okay? They wouldn't know how to land a Boeing 787. But there's a reasonable person that would know how to land it and do it appropriately. Okay, there's mild ignorance. Most people could be taught how to drive a car or tile. If you know what a gun does and you fire the gun, maybe there's some you know, person who doesn't know how to use a gun and they accidentally shoot a person. That's mild ignorance. That's mild ignorance. There's major ignorance. Like, well, is killing wrong in itself? That's a different. Those are two questions. Like the child shoots the gun. I think that's the point you're trying to make. I've heard it made that way. I think it's a good point. But you can continue.
No, that does make sense. But yes, I mean, you could have minor ignorance, and that could lead you to do actions which are bad. But you, again, you might not have intended. My crucial point here is that you're not necessarily intending to do something.
Yeah, but it's not like the pilots on the 9/11 planes. They knew how to fly the planes. It's not like they that wasn't the issue. You know, if someone. That wasn't the issue, you know. It's not like
So
two buildings.
Yeah. So in those cases, that's probably not ignorance, unless of course you want to make the claim that they somehow didn't know that they were innocent or something along those lines, which I think is unlikely, unless. But again, that's going to a prior discussion, because you could claim from that anybody who's not a Muslim in their view is a member of the House of War, and therefore anybody's a legitimate target. So you could rationalize it in that sense. We've done ignorance. So weakness of will. I mean, in those cases, that doesn't seem to be weakness of will, at least in respect of a passion. That doesn't seem to be something which was just someone riled them up. They got annoyed and lashed out. There was a premeditated one. So then you could then claim, oh, well, are these, is this malice? Is this something that you know is wrong? Have you deliberately set yourself on, does the will sort of set itself on an action which it knows to be evil in certain way, but goes on it anyway because of the good that will come towards them, or so they think, as a result of action? I think you possibly could determine that it would be malice, although then that would then hinge on the fact of whether it was in fact wrong or not. But I think those are kind of three types of sort of wrong action, which I think are an interesting categorization of three types of action you could take place of that have sort of quote unquote sinful actions that sort of out of ignorance. Out of ignorance, weakness of will, and malice. And of those you gave the example of, yes, it would be probably malice, assuming you thought what they did was wrong. But let's say then we're getting onto the discussion of whether that was a legitimate action in itself or not.
That to me is the million-dollar question, whether that is a legitimate action or not. I mean, for example, you know, my grandfather was in B-24 Liberators in the war in Pacific. I would most certain he killed people indirectly, of course, operating as a team, operating under a state action. You go in all debates over whether or not the Pacific War itself was just and whether or not the conduct of the war is just and so forth. was the actions. But then that goes back, falls into the examples of, you know, how do you get there? And do you have the ability to, maybe the Japanese or Dylann Roof or Osama bin Laden, they did not just have the ability to do it, you know. And actually in Plato's Republic, one of the interesting, almost libertarian points he makes is that, I think he makes this, is that, you know, if on the small level, the criminals, small criminals get punished by the state. But if you really think about it, when kings and armies go and enslave whole populations, you know, that's, and this is Hoppe and Chomsky both basically agree on this, that when kings and large states or corporations do it, that's considered justice. They set up the justice system. They set up the justice system. I believe he makes that in book one of the Republic system about what is justice. But and this is where, you know, is Plato a left winger? But nonetheless, I'm going to move into the next, you know, phase of this conversation, which is education. Okay. And you take all these people, I won't say my grandfather, but I'll say the commanding generals, you know, FDR, I forget the guy who ran the Pacific bombing campaign. I can't think of his name. He's interesting because he said if he lost the war, he would have been tried. And that's generally true. I mean, Hermann Goering basically say this in his defense at Nuremberg, that, you know, you Americans did the same thing under FDR, under the dictator principle. He actually quoted that. I think that's a very interesting comment to make. That's one of the things that Keith Preston brought up in the Schmidt argument, I believe. Or I might be reading Goering's testimony himself. But nonetheless, you take all these people, all these disagreeing interests, you know, all these people actions, you know, can we all educate them into, you know, harmony? Because when Socrates tries to define what is, you know, what is the good or what is justice, he says basic living in harmony. And this is sort of proto-Buddhist answer, but it's like, same way with, in a way, the Garden of Eden is a kind of harmony. Now, of course, Hans Hoppe said, well, the scarcity of bodies, maybe the scarcity of where to stand on there. But, you know, would there be any conflicts there? And this is just one of the points that I find interesting. But, you know, can we educate, air quote, educate? And this is where progressive education comes from. And, you know, again, of course, it was a minor thing. It was over minor things. You know, want to educate the ex-slaves into good citizens. This is again one of Thaddeus Russell's points he makes. And actually, in a backhanded way, the 1619 people make this too. They'll say, well, democracy came from ex-slaves. Well, then you're actually agreeing with Thaddeus Russell's point of the freedom of slavery, where he argues that slaves were more free in the sense that they were not held down by having to be, air quotes, good statesmen. And if you really think about what a senator or a president is, he's a good statesman. So the reason why blacks aren't, air quotes, good statesmen is because, well, they're not, they have the freedom of the slavery, but they don't have the other half, which is the slavery of freedom, which is like, you know, you have to, in order to set up this good society, you have to act in a magisterial manner. So, you know, that, and so forth. So that's why that explains that. That explains that in very, to degree. So this is where I think education is interesting. And, you know, what exactly is it? What exactly is ignorance? I mean, by a standard view, none of the people I listed, Hermann Goering, my grandfather, the 9/11 bomber, the 9/11 bombers, Dylann Roof, I could go on and on, the guy who prosecuted the war in Pacific, the guy who did the bombing of Dresden in Britain, you know, I could go on and on about, you know, list of people. They're not ignorant by any normal sense. They could pass a math test. They could pass a reading test. They could, you know, by standard views, standard thing, Osama bin Laden, Kim Jong, they're not idiots. Okay, they're not idiots in the normal sense. They all probably could do that. So they're not idiots in that sense. But could they all be educated to live in harmony? And this is where I think it starts becoming a sort of almost theological point. And my general view is no. My general view is no. There's a certain disharmony of certain human actions. And this is one of the. But before we go too farther, I want you to do overview of what the points I made so far about harmony and all these people and about ignorance. Swithin, any comments?
I would certainly agree that the guys we've mentioned so far are not ignorant in the way that you might consider idiots, etc. It's certainly they are sort of have obvious rationally functioning faculties. The question is, I think, in particular in this context, is are they, assuming that it is the case that the people who worked in the Twin Towers were not guilty of a crime which was justly punished by death. Assuming that's the case, does Osama bin Laden or the hijackers know that? That, I think, is kind of the question. And then that, you say, that does get to a good a theological question, because you can make the case that, well, you could make it a couple of ways. You could say, firstly, well, they didn't know it, but they should have known it, and they should have spent the time to work it out. So actually, their ignorance in that sense is culpable, because you could have argued they had an obligation to find out that it was in fact wrong, but they didn't. So that would be one way of going. Another way of going is, well, they knew it was wrong, but then, as it were, they suppressed it. So this goes back to a theological angle. Is an interesting example here would be, say, Romans 1, in which the Apostle Paul writes of some of the Gentiles and the Jews that they, what's the exact phrasing? They suppress the truth in unbelief. They decide that their wills focus on lesser goods than God, and then basically turn their focus on it in such a way to habituate their action away from what they kind of know to be good. And this kind of either not gets rid of the knowledge as such, but renders it so that it's effectively not accessed by the individual in question. And again, you could say that that is, in a sense, culpable, even though that's culpable, even though they're ignorant, although they're not ignorant in the same way as they would be in the previous example. So that's a way you could go. Do you think you could probably educate everybody? Well, no, I don't think so. Even if everybody, what this gets to is how do you have somebody who lives kind of like, as it were, the virtuous life? This is when it goes back to, because this is where, because Aristotle, I think, said that basically if you'd had a bad childhood, you were screwed. There was no way of living a virtuous life, because you would have had, by practice, habituated vicious or less than perfect actions as a child. And so because of the way sense perception and what appears good to individuals arises originally via sense perception, and that's kind of been cultivated in sort of a vicious manner, it's very difficult to get out of that. And so if you'd had a bad childhood, you wouldn't be virtuous. So it's kind of getting to the situation of how do you do what you think you should do? And I think experience shows that just knowing certain things doesn't mean that you'll actually achieve or do it. And I think this is where, in a way, sort of like the monastic view of things and the monastic practices actually are useful in cultivating behavior into a certain direction that you want to achieve, basically because you keep doing the same thing over and over again, you recite the same passages, etc., and it kind of ingrains into you in a more physical sense, such that you will behave differently as a result of it, as it were, out of habit and a natural one, rather than, well, I just have this this knowledge that this is the right thing to do and this is the wrong thing to do. Given the way humans are constituted, it needs to be anchored more in a more sort of visceral manner to achieve that. So you need a sense of a cultivation, habituation, rather than just intellectual assent to various propositions.
Oh, I agree that in some ways it's a habit. It's a habit, but I do think there's a continuum here of actions, that actions exist, and there's certain significant actions you could take, you know, that are sort of Rubicons, so to speak, where you do things points of no return or points of actions of significance. And this is actually one, the question that actually brought it up was the Taleb question. And one of Taleb's most recent book, which is somewhat weaker, is his book Skin in the Game. And one of his points was that decisions without consequences / benefits, debate over what exactly are consequences / benefits. This is one of his critiques of the public opinion polls and Nate Silver for a variety of reasons. Like if Nate Silver does not have $1 million behind it, he's not really wagering anything. You need to have money, but we need to have some, one of Taleb's examples is the helicopter mechanics that there's a study done. Now, again, you could prove anything with studies to a certain extent, but one of the interesting study once was done was that helicopter mechanics were forced to fly on the, do a test flight, make the helicopters, that they crash less. So that's hashtag skin in the game. That's hashtag skin in the game. So there's a case where the mechanic has the knowledge, okay? But his potential to be weak-willed gets removed by the fact that he knows he has to take, he might have to take a test ride in it. Sammurabi's code, this is where you get the legal symmetry of punishment. And this resolves the weakness of will problem. It's an interesting legal device to solve the weakness of will problem. But in this regard, then you don't get into any situations where you're above, over your head or under your head. But as far as, generalizing this, this becomes much more problematic, because, then it goes to what exactly is the nature of, education itself. The builder not building a house well, that's not, that's what I'd call minor ignorance. But this goes back to one of my examples of the person sitting on the bed who just wants to, smoke weed all day. This is one of the things that the 19th century reformers tried to educate out of people for better or worse. They drink themselves to death. That was the drink of choice. You could identify that as a good life. And again, that's a huge concession to make. It's a huge concession to make if we all agree on what is good life. But if, let's say we all do agree on what is a good life, then it becomes much more, I'm not sure if we can get peace and harmony there, because then we have different abilities to attain it too. And then you have different abilities to attain it and all sorts of problems. So Swithin, so far, what do you make of my points regarding skin in the game and then Hammurabi's code and the ability to attain things? Swithin?
I would certainly say that skin in the game is something good to counteract weakness of will. Why do you show up at work when you don't really want to, or because you'll get sacked if you don't? I mean, that's a pretty good incentive for you to turn up. Might not do very much when you're there, but you'll do enough to get by. There are certain things in place that you can introduce which can sort of kick you into the right direction. As to the good life, and even if you assume that you agree on what the good life is, that as you mentioned, one of the issues though is unless you have a very singular conception of what the good life is, one of the problems is going to be that in any given situation, what is good is going to be very, very heavily context dependent, because there are so many. You might be able to agree on general principles. Unless we have general principles in general, what a good life would look like. We may be able to sketch various archetypes of, yes, or in this situation, this is a good life, this is a good life. So what is a good life for the man living under National Socialist occupation in France, vis-a-vis an Aryan German in National Socialist Germany? It may be different. Because what is able for them to do, et cetera, et cetera. Also, another one you might make is, let's suppose I see a child drowning. I can swim, therefore I should go in and try and get him out. Fine. Oh, yeah, but you've got no legs. Oh, well, you better just ring somebody to help. Okay, that's fine. And they're relatively easy to work out. But then you have the issue of any specific situation. There are so many different circumstances involved that even when you know the general principles, it's particulars that matter. And you can have significant debates over which particulars are relevant, even if you go from the general principles, and that can in its way cause conflict. So a related sort of theological example with lockdowns, various people in the reformed group would say, well, some would agree that, yes, the government does have various, rightly or wrongly, in your view, whether this is true or not, the question, they would argue that the government has certain powers in states of emergency to do things it otherwise wouldn't do. So those are kind of like the general principles that both some sides in the reform debate agreed. But then they disagreed on, well, whether the coronavirus situation was actually a genuine state of emergency which justified those particular forms of action. And then you're getting bogged down into a whole host of different issues, even when you decide on the general principles. Unless you want to take the view that there is always the good life, it always looks the same everywhere and always, you're always going to get conflict. And then it's a course of, you know, how do you get people to act harmoniously? I mean, because you can have situations in which both parties of goodwill who are both sort of intending to do what they believe to be good, and they deal with each other in good faith, they can have disagreements. So I think what you want to try to do is cultivate various sort of virtues. But even if you do that, I don't see how you're going to resolve all sort of conflict, even if you were in the Garden of Eden, to take the Hoppian example, at least.
My suspicion of education remains the same. One of the points that Michael Brooks once made was, and this is the Zero Books point, is that the right is the true postmodernist. And I think in some technical, if you get really technical, the Calvinists are the only, whether or not Aquinas is one, people like Jeff Durbin, R.C. Sproul, would try to argue that he is. They'd argue, well, because, you know, things exist, therefore things exist, an unmoved mover, and, you know, you need a necessary being. You get into these sort of opaque arguments at times. They would argue that, you know, well, the left isn't really that way. The left doesn't really believe in any of those things. So they just borrowed them all from Christianity. And I think there's a great Calvinist passage says that Hegel did this. And since Hegel is certainly the founding father of this movement. But nonetheless, as far as action is concerned, my reason for being suspicious of education is that it's not, you know, whom exactly is educating whom? You know, when Jeff Durbin goes out to the street, one of the points, which I think mirrors Socrates' points in Book One of the Republic, is about friends. Jeff Durbin will say that take homosexuality. Now, again, I'm a plumb libertarian to say this, but you know, Jeff Durbin would argue that the people who advocate homosexuality or abortion to mothers and to things are actually doing evil. And the only thing that he is afraid of is he hasn't done enough. I think he's basically said that. And that's the same way the abolitionist position in 1860 regarding slavery. But although, interestingly enough, you could also flip that around and say the only thing that Hitler was ashamed and Goebbels was ashamed, they didn't kill enough Jews or they didn't defend Germany well enough. You can flip these examples to make them politically correct, politically incorrect, politically correct or politically incorrect all you want all day long. And I think it's an interesting activity in itself to do. But as far as education itself, do you think there is a kind of universal education program that can make this is a big ask of a question, but I have my own answer. My own answer would be something probably not. No solutions, just trade-offs. You might be able to teach everyone to know how to do certain activities, like, I don't know, write or read, or at least a large majority of people. Okay, those kind of education, I think, that kind of technical education can easily be done to a broad-based population. And actually, in some ways, and this is one of the hilarious points, I think people should be careful what they fish for, particularly the left, is like Hermann Goering is a very smart guy, same way with Goebbels, and same way with a lot of all these people in the far right, as well as the far left. The right has just as much problem. You know, Hegel et al., Chomsky, these aren't idiots either. So, you know, more education actually might have a negative effect. It's actually, I see all these centrist movements in the United States. And one of the odd advices of the centrist movements is to watch less news and read less. I haven't actually explicitly seen that, but it's somewhat vaguely implied in one of the premises. Just be more ignorant. Just focus on what you're around. Focus on what's around you. I sometimes do this. This is actually Jordan Peterson's advice too. You know, don't try to change the world. Just try to organize your room. Now, Zizek would say, well, I can't organize my room because the society is in disorder. Well, then how exactly do you get society in order? I do think education has weird consequence, continuing education and continuing development. I think that has weird consequences. And I for both the right and the left. Now, of course, R.C. Sproul, I mean, if R.C. Sproul was put in Commissar, I actually think society would have good, if Jeff Darby and R.C. Sproul, if they were actually willing to take that position, I don't think if you take, they would actually take it because they know that power is corrupting. But even if they did, I mean, you could argue that, like, the closest thing we had was, like, the late 1800s United States and Britain and Germany that were sort of vaguely run by some vaguely, in a sense, Puritan theocrats. And we produced a ton of wealth in, like, 60 years in development, in, like, 60 years, which is quite incredible. You know, it all scaled back since the 1960s, as Tyler Cowen argues in The Great Stagnation. But nonetheless, as far as education programs, you know, what's your view on, you know, educating people in general or in particular? Do you think it has, do you think people should be careful what they fish for to a certain extent as far as education is concerned? Technical education aside. Swithin?
I think you want to make a distinction between, I think you were trying to do it with technical education, between what you could broadly call schooling and education. In a way, you're, as you said, with technical education, you're kind of, if you define, say, education, so the cultivation of your sort of mind or your body, that happens all the time in sort of on the job or whatever. You are being educated and you're being inculcated with certain values and various things that way, and that's equally education to sitting down with books, etc. The question is, well, what's the most appropriate? And I think education, as people generally understand it, which is basic forms of schooling or sort of formal education, simply is, even if it was done by good people with good intentions, I think would not be appropriate for a lot of people, just because they're just not suited to it. There aren't that many particularly intellectual individuals by disposition. I mean, it might change as they age, but I've taught some pretty stupid people, and there would be no point in trying to teach them the finer points of Aristotelian metaphysics. There simply would be no point in doing, because they wouldn't grasp it. Does that mean that you couldn't attempt to do some basic form? Maybe. But there would be no point going beyond a particular level. And really what you would want to do is just to cultivate virtues in the circumstances in which they find themselves, which I suppose is kind of a Peterson-style point. And act accordingly. And then if they have a situation where they don't know what to do, they don't know the right thing to do is, then this is a not particularly desirable situation to be in a certain sense. Just ask somebody who knows better than them. So traditionally the priest or the vicar or somebody who knows what a particular moral situation would be. Or maybe it's a complicated issue with a wife and child in utero, and what would constitute abortion, what wouldn't, what's the moral course of action. There's lots of issues here which are difficult to work out. I mean, not everybody's going to grasp all the nuances of all the arguments, and there's no reason to suspect that they would. So I'm highly suspicious of trying to foist sort of quote-unquote education on people, because in most times it's not education, it's just getting them to think what they want them to think. It's getting them to come to the conclusions they want to, rather than explaining the process of, by way of coming to them. And the reason they don't do that is because not that many people are suited for doing that.
I would tend to agree that education would have the same fallout here. I think to a certain extent both sides have fine air quotes, both sides have fine people on it. But so I'm going to circle back to the beginning question here before we end this. As far as some of the people I've listed, which I think is somewhat interesting, do you think they are air quote evil? Do you think there are air quote evil people you yourselves with? And you're more of the, you know, the Aquinas Christian than I am. what exactly is Aquinas' position on this? And do you think those people, what's the relationship there between that? Swithin?
I'm no authority on Aquinas. I would say, as I mentioned earlier, I think what we're really talking about evil would be that is a malicious action. That is, you know all the relevant facts, but you still choose to do the wrong action. You could probably make that case maybe with Osama bin Laden. Dylan Roof is difficult because of his upbringing, etc. You could claim there's certain ignorances or there's certain passions. Although passions are cultivated over time, so you can kind of cultivate particular dispositions. Although that's true of malice as well. So were they guilty of malice, which is kind of the worst form of sin in this context? Probably. But I would have to, I'd have to do more work on really figuring out exactly how to distinguish between all three. But I think on a prima facie basis, it kind of makes sense. You can make a distinction between the guy who finds his wife with another guy and then kills him in the room, from somebody else who has been slighted by a guy over numerous time periods and slowly but surely working out the best way to kill him. I mean, they're two sort of different situations, and I think it's the latter, the sort of malice aforethought thing, which comes from sort of a legal context, is kind of where malice and kind of true evil, as it were, lies.
Yeah, this goes, there are certain local examples which are interesting, and I want to follow up one minor point, and this will be my final statement here. The point about not getting out of bed in the morning or you starve, it's a fairly strong, like, natural reasoning to do so. And this is actually one of the reasons why socialism only really develops wealthy societies in my purview, in my view. Because, and this is the Keith Preston point made in an interview done 2 to 3 years ago, is that, like, they forced people to work too, because otherwise things would fall apart. But as far as the actions done by major significant figures, I think this is an extremely interesting question. And actually, the people who do the terrorist actions are in self, for better or for worse, are kind of an elite. It's like we did an episode on suicide. In some ways, suicide is suicide a brave act or a cowardly act? It's probably in some sense a brave act to do actual violent suicide, the kind of, you know, the sort of samurai types, you take a sword and take your, a kind of flippant sort of suicide, and that kind of brave action. A terrorist action, that's a kind of brave action. Even war itself is a kind of, brave action. So in some ways there are degrees of honor, and that's one of the points that some of the classical virtues in some ways are. So this has been very interesting discussion, Swithin. Thanks for doing it, and Swithin.
Yes, I think it's an interesting discussion about for what reasons people do what they do. I would say in general, I tend not to ascribe evil to people to a large extent and try to sort of really understand why they're doing what they're doing. I think just in general political discourse, orange man bad, he's evil. He's like, well, he might be in certain respects, but in other respects, is he? And then compared to other people. So I think we really want to have all relevant facts available when we're analysing the sort of moral character or worth of anyone's particular action. Just like to thank everyone for listening. If you've enjoyed the show, please subscribe to us on YouTube and share it with your friends and family. And if you'd like to contact the show, please contact us at mindcrimelibertyshow@gmail.com. That's mindcrimelibertyshow@gmail.com.